The whole experience at the Hopi Nation was so moving, and we got a chance to be with some elders, and it was pretty incredible. And I sort of capped my antenna. I wanted to, it interlaced with our Dharma practice in some really beautiful ways. So I wanted to share some of that. And, great compassion, and that's what I was wanted to talk about. And it suggests this real awareness of all sentient beings, that they not suffer, a real broad-hearted awareness with no being left out, with every being cared for just as ourselves. And this is something that we talk about, but the Hopi are amazing. It's an area where our Buddhist understanding, it's in harmony with indigenous sisters and brothers. And it really came, it sort of clarified being on the reservation, being on the nation, the Hopi nation, that there was a real powerful synergy there. So I just wanted to share kind of where that's fresh. It's the second time there, and we sort of went a whole different layer than the first time there. We sort of kind of we'd really taken it in. It meant a lot. We talked about it a lot over the years. So somehow it just clicked in deeply. We connected with people a lot more, with Hopi people. And it was profound. So the Hopi, they're just a little background. They're one of, I mean, all the native people were traumatized by colonialization and invasion, no doubt. But in some ways, they weren't as much as some, partly because their ancestral lands don't have anything or didn't have anything valuable on it, like gold. So we white people kind of left them alone, more or less, not really, but to some degree. And also because of the strength of their culture, they, to a large degree, didn't get Christianized. There are a few churches, but their traditional practices are very much cooking. And people we talked to, everybody was referring to what clan they were in and the kiva they went to and, all that kind of stuff. So it's very alive for them. And they have amazing values. Like, it's one tribe, they have repeatedly voted to not have a casino. Even when the state of Arizona offered them $1 million, which is at seed money, they still voted it down. So there's no casino there, which is great because the vibes are really different. And if you ever go there's only one place you can stay, which is a Hopi Cultural Center run by the tribe. There's no commercial hotels. There's a couple of gas stations and an auto parts store and one little grocery store. It's pretty big though. It's surrounded by the Navajo reservation, which is huge, which is as big as Rhode Island. So the Hopi reservation is a little bubble in the middle of the Navajo reservation. So you're buffered by, this whole giant reservation. So it's amazing. It's really amazing. So the high point was visiting Walpi Village. There's three mesas, Mesa 1, 2, and 3. You can even pick them up on Google Map. If you search for Mesa 1, First Mesa is how it'll pull it up. And First Mesa is where Walpi Village is. There's three villages up there. And Walpi, it's been there 1,200 years. It's founded in 800. It's been there 1,200 years. And it's amazing. They also have chosen in that village, there's no power, there's no plumbing, there's no electricity. Not that many people live there, but some people do, where they live down the valley and come back up. But some people live there. It's just wonderful, and you're up on top of the mesa, and it drops off like 300 feet straight down to the floor. And so this tribal elder gave us a tour. You can't go there unless you do it with a. You got to do it with a Hopi person as a tour guide. You can't just go up there. And he was a member of the Fire Clan, and. Told us that part of his responsibility was having the fires correct when they do the kiva ceremonies, and there are 16 kivas. A kiva is an underground ceremonial area where they do practices. They have to go down a ladder, and then there's a beautiful, I should have pulled it up here, but anyways, I don't want to get too Hopi on things, but there's a beautiful painting in the which I showed to Brittany in the Hopi, which I can show you afterwards. Anyone that's interested in the Hopi Cultural Center of what their practice is, like a visualization of their practice when they're in the kiva, and then there's all these spirits floating in the sky all around that have been attracted. So, but there was during that try, he volunteered. Maybe we said something about Buddhist practice, but he volunteered. He said, "Yeah, there's parallels. There's similarities there." He was a kind of a warm connection that he brought up. And then the other, we had two guides at different times. The other guide twice mentioned rebirth. And I finally, I said, okay, I'm going out on a limb, but is in your heart, is it possible that some of us white people could have been native before? And I expect them to say, absolutely no. But he said, yeah, I think that could be the case. I was like, oh, damn. So there was a sense of connection. And I think partly because my wife's a tiny bit native and she carries that with her. I mean, she's a part of who Ellen is in a lot of ways. So that's sort of connected. So he had some real heartwarming kind of connections with people. It was pretty cool. And he was from the Corn and Water Clan, the one other elder that drove us around more. So I think the thing that was striking, that like we sort of soaked in, you know, because we were there for 5 days. There's nothing to do in a way. I mean, you're not supposed to kind of just go wandering around on Hopi land, pretty kind of. So we went, you could go hiking out the back of our place, and there were some wonderful canyons back off there about a mile. That was cool. And we did two tours and kind of went hiking off in the canyons again. You know, it was just nothing. You could only soak it in. There was really nothing to do. I even talked to someone in Flagstaff when we got back who runs this very lovely store with all these herbs and native art, and she really works well with the tribes. And she said, what do you do for 5 days? You know, but we just were kind of in this absorbing. I woke up at 3 a.m. one time. It's hard to describe, but I felt this incredible peace, like there was nothing going on that was out of harmony with anything around me, off for miles and miles and miles, which is not here. It's, you know how it is. I don't think we're aware how much there's thoughts flying around in the energy and all kinds of stuff flying around in the energy. And there wasn't. It was really amazing. And so there was underlying this, and this is where it's getting to compassion, was what I heard and felt and absorbed was this real profound embracing of the welfare of the land. It's their land, and also all the beings on it. It's all interwoven, and they, as people, weren't separated from all of that. And there was a real compassion. It was a real automatic wishing for the welfare of everything. And they were telling, several people told us how they grow corn down, and there's a particular corn that's been handed down for centuries that'll work in that climate. It's dry. But they've tried, a few people have tried bringing in hybrid corn, and it just doesn't work. It won't grow. And even try bringing their corn and planting it somewhere else, and it won't grow either. It only grows there and works out well there. So they've just evolved this real harmony kind of evolution. So they still plant corn, they still plant beans, they still plant squash as these fields down around the mesas. And yeah, it was pretty amazing. So everything was sacred. So I'm going to, a few quotes that I want to, not that I heard there, but I, you know, found them on the web, but nonetheless, quotes in this arena, just to get a sense of what some of the elders have said about these relationships. So Thomas, I'm going to butcher the name, Banyacha, said in the 1940s, he said, the Hopi people have been chosen by the Creator to be caretakers of this land, not exploiters. We are taught to walk gently upon it with humility and gratitude. All things are connected. When we harm the earth, we harm ourselves. And the more contemporary Hopi elder Dan Evehema said, the life of all creatures is sacred to the Hopi. The animals, the birds, the insects, all are our relatives. They were placed here with us to remind us how to live in balance. To mistreat them is to violate the sacred. And then a third Hopi prayer, to follow the path of right living is to walk in harmony with all of creation. You will see that all is sacred, the stone, the tree, the animal, the rain. To forget this is to lose your way. I did have an opportunity at the, some of you know, I went to the Parliament of the World's Religions in Toronto a bunch of years ago, and I did a bunch of interviews, and I had a chance to interview a Hopi elder talking about water. And that was similar kind of, it was just so moving. He had this real sense of water, and it's precious there, but harmony with the water. So the Buddha taught great compassion also in a different way, and there's a special emphasis in the Mahayana, but it's a way to recognize and support the welfare of all beings. And to me, I sort of gained a better understanding of what the Buddha taught from this exposure to these people. Maybe that's a way of saying what I wanted to share. Because this, you know, just there's so many different avenues to awakening that the Buddha taught. But great compassion, it gets us past our constricted self-interest. It frees us from attachment to what we think we need. And that is a journey toward nibbana, toward liberation. Because ultimately, as many of you know, there's no inherent self. So this is from a Buddhist point of view. The whole idea is no inherent self. We're all compounded phenomena. We just don't realize that. And we get stuck in thinking that we are concrete. And so, you know, ultimately, anything that any being does out of self-interest is based on an illusion. It's not that thing that they're trying to augment doesn't even exist anyway. So it doesn't work. It's ruinous. It doesn't help. And, you know, they have this thing about the he who dies with the most toys wins, whatever. But, you know, actually, they just died. And how did that help them? And what about the next lifetime if that's part of it? So any kind of grasping doesn't work. I often think about, you know, some of the ultra-rich persons that are running around right now wielding way too much power. And they got a couple decades, maybe, or they might die tomorrow when their toy crashes. You never know. But it's all that grasping does not accomplish anything, and it's out of harmony. It's out of harmony with the interconnection of life. It's this isolated self-aggrandizement built on this great citadel of wealth that means nothing. And it felt so clarified in that world. I could just see it in a whole deeper way that self-interest gets you nowhere. It's just, it's sad. It's really sad. So from the viewpoint of these elders, you can see that loving kindness and great compassion, they're completely interwoven. As some of you know, there's the four Brahma Viharas, and it's compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And those first two, loving kindness and compassion, they're completely sort of co-emergent. Loving kindness or metta is the whole idea of radiating goodwill toward all beings, wishing them happiness. Karuna is related, and it's that wishing that they be free from suffering, wishing that they be free from suffering. So from this kind of looking at through the Hopi lens, it didn't have quite the distinction that it does in Buddhist world, because there's this whole idea of suffering and dukkha that's sort of buried in Buddhist perspective that isn't there the same way in Hopi world, in my humble, small, tiny understanding. But you could really feel how they were integrated. I guess that's the beauty part. You know, they were really integrated in this incredible embracing of all life in a way that, you know, we're not separate. And I really kind of got it that even us Westerners, you know, when we're really working on compassion, we're still kind of separate. We sort of do it like we're being compassionate with those people over there or these people over here. It's not like we're not interwoven in the same way that in an indigenous. I mean, can you imagine living in one place where your ancestors have lived for 1,200 years and everybody's interconnected in terms of family structures and clan structures, and everybody knows who everybody's clan is, and it's almost unfathomable. And it was such, I mean, it's tribal in a beautiful way, but we're so separated that we can't, you know, we don't even realize how separated we are. We kind of compare ourselves to a culture that is like that. So I think I learned something that to bring home in terms of our practice, that to be mindful about even when we're doing loving kindness practice or compassion practice, to not do it in a separated way, like I am doing it for someone else, just to connect. It's like a whole different sense of it, you know, just to connect and realize that we're all in it together. Because I can see this innate interconnectedness was just woven through all the contacts that we had there. And I think it's probably in many ways closer to what the Buddha's reality was than we might think. Because, you know, I've been to India a bunch of times, and I've been to places where the Buddha was. And even now, there's places that aren't that different than they were 2,500 years ago. I've been to some little villages where it's just a, there's a couple of water buffalo and not much of anything, and that's where the Buddha was, and it's not that different. And people are living in a very immediate, on the ground, connected, up against each other kind of way, still in parts of rural India. And here, we're so insulated. You know how it is, air conditioning, cars, the whole deal. We're so separated in little boxes. But if you're there on the dirt in a village where there's, three motorcycles and six bicycles and one car, you're much more there together, and how people care for each other is much more visceral. So, and I kind of extrapolated, and I thought a lot about the Buddha's life in India, because he spent, as many of you know, he spent 40 years teaching, pretty much going 300 miles up and down the Ganges Valley from Sravasti, where his family was, to kind of the area around Bodh Gaya and north of that, Ultra Peak and stuff. He kind of walked back and forth and taught people as they appeared, and did alms round, and then sat for the days abiding. That's what they did pretty much, until someone came up to talk to him. And so he practiced a lot, even though he was awakened, but it's in the dirt or in the jungle, surrounded by animals. And it gave me a whole deeper sense of what this compassion and loving kindness is about. So it was actually really helpful. And the whole our pests and vermin, I mean, it drives me crazy anyway, but sort of it hurt me more that, well, what's a pest? Some little four-legged mammal that just wants to live? Or what's vermin, really? You want to shoot a coyote because it's taking your chickens, but they've been there long before you have, my friend. So it's heart-opening to understand that these are sentient beings just like us, and to really honor them and to have that loving kindness towards them. Because sometimes in the West, it's great that people care for dogs and do dog shelters and stuff. But the dogs are beautiful and wonderful. The cats are beautiful. The horses are beautiful. Okay. But what about the ones that aren't beautiful? Or they stink, or they eat your chickens, and then what about all the cows that we eat that we don't think they're so beautiful, we just eat them. So that sense of kind of just interconnectedness and really honoring all sentient beings, it's really striking. And then in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha said, whatever living beings there may be, feeble or strong, long, stout, or medium, short, small, or large, seen or unseen, those dwelling far or near, those who are born, those yet to be born, may all beings without exception be happy in themselves. So you can really put some kind of heart on that, from just thinking about our Hopi brothers and sisters, that he was really talking about all sentient beings because he ran into them all the time, and he didn't step on them, and he saw them, and they were there, and there was monkeys swinging from trees overhead, and all the stuff that goes on in forests in Asia. And also the Hopi look at the earth as an organism. I heard that several people when I was there, and I've kind of read that stuff, but it kind of hit me more, is that they're aware of the earth, this globe that we're on as an organism, that you have to be kind to it. You don't just mess with it. You don't dig big holes, as one Hopi said, that the tribe made a mistake and let some coal mine be put in, and it was just, now they're, it was he for him it was like a kind of a rape, that they had dug big holes in the earth and did it in this incredibly unconscious machine way, and now they're fixing it back up and having ceremonies and kind of restoring the energy. So it's this real deep heart sense of honoring the earth. And from their point of view, I mean, in terms of what we're up to, we white folks with money and power and everything, they're just kind of like, oh my God, they're kind of worried, actually. I mean, I know we're kind of worried, but they're worried from a different point of view. And several people said they feel like they're helping to hold the whole earth together, because they're doing their practice and really connecting with the whole Mother Earth, and really keeping it in harmony. Because, in the West, we tend to look at family like kind of a fortress, So everyone's got their little nuclear family, and then everybody else is on the outside, and there's all these preppers that have all this food, and they have semi-automatic weapons and all this stuff to protect their little nuclear thing. There's not a sense of the interconnectedness of people really looking out for each other. And, you know, I mean, even our Northwest tribes, the whole potlatch tradition where giving away was, that was, the wealth was if you could give away wealth. That's how you were wealthy, to be able to give to your other people in your tribe. So we got it kind of backwards. But this helps me see how the Buddha was, you know. He saw there was no separation, that all sentient beings are in this together, and really honoring that. And he taught that we have to get away from self-interest to really cherish others. We have to get away from our clinging to our sense of self, which just causes all kinds of problems, and we end up in opposition. And, you know, it may be the political dichotomies we're in are because people get vested in their positions and identify with it and throw up barriers and the other one's evil. And, you know, both sides are, I get that, both sides are doing that in various ways out of fear. But there's not that heart opening of just loving kindness for all beings. Now, there's a wonderful text that is in Mahayana tradition, Tibetan tradition, Guided a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, that I've had a lot of exposure to over my life. Is written by Shantideva, who was at Nalanda. Some of you know there was a 700 years, it was Nalanda University, it was in what is now Bihar, and it was the center of Buddhist thought for this huge long period, and Shantideva lived there. There's a story that he was very relaxed, and they didn't think he was actually much of a practitioner. And I'm going to get this sort of wrong, but they sort of challenged him to a debate. And then he prepared by writing the Guided Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which he then did an oral discourse on, but he floated to the place and came down, levitating, and came down to do it. So it's just this extraordinary text, really worth reading if you ever are so moved. The Dalai Lama's, he's done week-long teachings on just one chapter. And it's really simple, very contemporary, quite brief, just really works here. It completely works in 2025. And around this arena of getting out of ourselves and caring for all beings, Shantideva says, I'm going to read a couple little quotes. He says, if I do not give away my happiness to others, there is no way to attain the state of Buddhahood. If I do not take upon myself the suffering of others, I shall never reach awakening. So he's really in a very radical way, just going past self-interest. Because remember the Buddha's core statement, I teach suffering in the end of suffering. And suffering has everything to do, is a lot of us, you know, aware of the Four Noble Truths. And there's this fact that life is unsatisfactory if we cling, if that's how we operate in terms of a concretized self, trying to get the good stuff for us instead of someone else, and focusing on getting experience or self-satisfaction. That doesn't work. Because we get caught, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, so does pain and pleasure. We ping pong back and forth, but we can be free of that. That's the end of suffering, to be free of that. And Shantideva is saying, in a radical way, to get away from self-orientation, which is kind of what, in a different way, the Hopi were talking about, because they're so interconnected. There's not a sense of, someone told me that early on, someone said, yeah, if you go on a Navajo reservation, the guys are kind of like this. You go on the Hopi reservation and they're really sweet. It's not like this. They don't do bravado. It was really interesting. I felt like that too. Navajo's a lot tougher. I mean, they're still wonderful, but it's a little different. So the Buddha's, you know, unique contribution is insight into clinging and attachment and not self. I mean, this is what the Buddha really brought that's different from Hindu tradition. And the whole sense of dukkha, you know, the first arrow of pain, the second arrow of suffering, the second one's optional. We may have pain, we don't have to suffer. That just that core understanding of how we navigate life. And the Buddha had a lot of pain in his life, but he didn't suffer. So pain's universal. Suffering, the second arrow, is optional. And that's what our practice is about, and that's what we do. You know, when we're doing mindfulness practice, we're kind of seeing through everything that comes up, we're mindful of it, we see through it, a little less sticking, a little less attachment, a little less identification, slowly, slowly, it peels away. And we're not caught in those twin fangs as much, slowly, slowly, but It changes who we are. You look at the monks, those of you had had contact with Ajahn Nisibo and Ajahn Kovalo, very much worth doing. They're coming out of retreat on Saturday. They've been 3 month retreat, and so the Saturday morning at St. Mark's, and they're just amazing. You know, I've been around those guys since they first arrived, and it's like outer circumstance just kind of doesn't matter. It's just astonishing. I remember when Ajahn Nisibo had a crack in his foot or something, so he was on crutches, and they do alms round. They come, I know I've said this before, but it was still so striking. They do alms round. That's what they do. They don't have no money. They can't keep food overnight. They can't grow food. They can't buy food. They can't ask for anything but water. And so they take they're staying in a Tula Huts in Southworth. They take the ferry over, walk up to Pike Place Market, get there about 7:05 with their alms bowl. Whatever people put in their bowl, that's what they're going to eat, and they have to leave at 7:40 to get the ferry back. And but Ajahn Nisibo, it would be like January, 35 degrees, pissing down rain, on crutches, coming up, and he had to walk a mile to get on crutches to the ferry and then walk from the Coleman dock up to, and he was just like beaming, basically. I mean, he was just in this moment. I say, dude, it's like, you don't have a hat on, it's raining. He said, it's okay. That's fine. You know, he just never kind of noticed because he was just in this place of much broader. So it's so similar. It was like, there's something very similar to what the Hopi were up to. But great compassion, you know, it turns into a wish for other beings to be free. And this is sliding a little bit into the Mahayana way of bodhicitta, the intent to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings, which is a kind of a slighter of an emphasis than Theravada, although they're not black and white. But there's something beautiful. That's why I've got a chunk of Mahayana in me that I continue to practice, because there's something beautiful about the way that pulls us out of our self-interest. You know, if we really are dedicating ourselves to awakening for the sake of all sentient beings, that's like one more step. It's really profound. And it really pulls us out of subtle ways in which we're stuck on ourselves. There's a criticism, I don't think it's really fair, that Theravada is more thinking about their own self-liberation. I think actually, you know, the great Theravada beings I've been around, they're totally working for all sentient beings. I mean, they're amazing, they're radiant. It's not like you're sitting around. But nonetheless, there's something very beautiful about this aspiration, great compassion to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings, that has an element of it that to me kind of interweaves with what I was picking up from the Hopi people. Because there's a sense that every sentient being is just as important as oneself, and therefore you're dedicated to them all in this inherent, built-in way. It's not just an idea, but it's just like way down in your actual bones. So it's a magic. And being around those elders, it just felt like they kind of didn't have self-interest. It's hard to describe, but they were just kind of couldn't find it. There was no strutting. There was no nothing. Just this universal thing. So in the Guided Bodhisattvas, in the chapter 8 on meditation, he says, just as I defend myself, he said, oftentimes it's sort of a dialogue in that text. You got to kind of sort through the dialogue part. But I don't think that's happening here. Just as I defend myself from all unpleasant happenings, however small, likewise, I shall act for others' sake to guard and shield them with compassion. So he's kind of like looking at what he does and then saying, okay, he's going to turn that around and act for others' sake. Now, I'm almost done here. This is, to be sure, 2025, a perilous time. I mean, there's political things, but I actually went online. Some of you know the Union of Atomic Scientists. They have this thing called a doomsday clock, where they, since for decades and decades, have been keeping track of how close we are to. And they actually moved it I didn't know this, on January 28th, they moved it to 89 seconds before midnight, the closest it's ever been in the history of that. So from their point of view, they had a long thing that was, but one statement just says, because the world is already perilously close to the precipice, a move of even a single second should be taken as an indication of extreme danger and an unmistakable warning that every second of delay in reversing course increases the probability of global disaster. So that's kind of grim. And in the longer thing, they talk about climate change and the proliferation of nuclear weapons and all this stuff. I say that because There was one other quote that I put at the end here. This same Hopi elder, Dan Eve Hema, he said, "Only by joining together in a spiritual peace with love in our hearts for one another, love in our hearts for the Great Spirit and Mother Earth, shall we be saved from the terrible purification day, which is just ahead." So Hopi prophecy talks about some difficult times ahead, folks. And these people really, I mean, the elders we talked to, they really felt like they're working to help the earth, to help all of us in their own traditional practice. And I've heard Dharma leaders, I know, you know, I know people who are solitary meditators, and they feel like that's what their work is helping the whole, the earth together. And I kind of believe that a lot. I mean, if you have a bunch of people in caves and they are like in Buddha nature, radiating compassion across the world, we need that badly. So what we do, you know, we're called to regard each sentient being as precious as ourselves and dedicating ourselves to awakening to free all beings. That's pretty straight up. So that's the one way of looking at what this journey is. And, you know, I'm almost done, but it may be that rebirth is true. I personally am getting increasingly convinced, despite my innate skepticism, that it is true. Because there's a lot of data and all kinds of stuff, you know, from IMs and all kinds of things that are shifting the needle. I'm pretty much convinced that it's true. And it may be that life exists in other world systems. I'm also pretty convinced that's true. So we're not here all alone. And Buddhist masters and Hopi masters both agree. I mean, they both agree in rebirth and Mahayana. They're always talking about I do it myself in dedication, dedicating to beings in other world systems. But this makes this whole journey we're on, this spiritual journey we're on for us human beings here in our, you know, our fathom long bodies and our 70 or whatever years we got, kind of much more immense because, you know, if we die in some horrendous problem 10 years from now, we'll be back somewhere. And if we don't die, we have a peaceful death, and we're born 100 years from now, it could be really gnarly if we are born on this earth. So in any case, it calls on us to cultivate, do the best we can, you know, cultivate the path, cultivate compassion, embrace all beings. And the mere fact that you all are here, you know, there's something in your hearts that moves you. You could have been water skiing, that was kind of cool, but whatever, doing fun things. But there's something that brought you here, and there's something many of you I know have been practicing for many, many, many years. And you know, more than ever, the conditions, the outer conditions are unstable. We don't know what's going to happen. But I think what the Hopi really showed and that we can bring into our Dharma practice is this real reverence for the earth, for life, to really bring it in a deeper way than we might have conceptualized when we're trying to sort of absorb Dharma things from our books and our audios and however we do it. So that's kind of what I wanted to share in this way. You know, our job is to cultivate compassion and freedom and love. It's the only way out. And in the very last chapter 8, he says, "I should eliminate the suffering of others because it is suffering, just like my own. I should help others because they are sentient beings, just like myself." So, may it be so. Sit for a moment.